Everyone, the live show is this Saturday, February 27th. Go to creeklic.com for more information. Henry's back in town. Our first one in a couple months coming out. We'll see you there.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the last podcast.
On the left.
That's when the cannibalism started.
If Obama killed Scalia, why didn't he just leave like a naked dead boy in there with him as well?
I don't know. Maybe they ran out. Yeah.
And like a fake diary just being like, Filipino Kermit's like, please cover my Pop-Tart.
Agent Roger, you brought the dead boy, right?
God damn it,
Agent Roger. You're off the force.
I left it at the Popeyes.
All right. Welcome to the last podcast on the left, everyone. I am Ben Kissel, as always, staring at the beautiful Marcus Parks.
Hey.
With us finally back from disgusting Los Angeles.
I was trying to fake the 9/11 crash, but then I was going to drop off the passports next to the World Trade Center, but oh God, I left it at the Dunkin' Donuts. These slippery fingers of mine.
Is that what you were discussing while you were there speaking with models and things like that?
Oh yeah, making money.
I think you were making less friends somehow. Yes. You went there with zero friends and you came back with -5 friends.
No, I spent a great time with Mary and Andrew Parker. We went out and we saw the Nicole Brown Simpson house, and it was, I'll say, fun. We had fun. Sure. But then we showed up. So we showed up to the Nicole Brown Simpson house. Mm-hmm. We were looking for the proper address.
Right.
So we're sitting there and we're like, okay, should we take some pictures? And we're like, okay, yeah, we're going to pose like, you know, Nicole Brown. We're going to pose like Ron
Goldman.
Like the
two victims of a murder.
Heinous murder. We're having fun. And then all of a sudden this woman comes out of her car. We're like, okay, we're about to get shut down. And it was just some normal kind of suburbanite woman, like full updo, like dressed like she'd just come from the office. She was just like, she's like, which one of these is the Nicole Brown Simpson house?
Oh,
we're like, this
God.
Is awesome. We're all like this.
It is so nice. The world treats death with such respect.
Yeah.
Anyway, time for Dean Corll Part 3.
Well, before we get back into the story of Dean Corll, we're going to talk a little bit about sexual sadism.
Oh, is that? It's sadist. I thought it was sexual sadist, but I was thinking about my life.
No, never do that. You are a sexual sadist.
Oh, I see.
And I think that's a really good name for your comedy album.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah, we'll go with that.
Well, sexual sadism is defined as a paraphilia in which the experience of causing extreme pain, suffering, or humiliation gives the sadist sexual pleasure.
Now, a paraphilia is a sexual predilection that is outside the normal, quote-unquote, boundaries of sexuality, correct?
A fetish.
Yes.
The DSM-5 defines, I think, 4 or 5 different paraphilias as a separate mental illness. Sadism, exhibitionism, pedophilia is another one. And then the sixth one is all other philias.
What's the DSM-5?
The DSM-5 is the handbook for mental illness.
Yeah,
it's like the guidebook.
It's if you're cuckoo or not. Basically, it goes as a checklist. Like, if you go in and you're like, I see a talking rabbit, it tells me to illustrate itself, and I hear radio noises in my head, and I have night sweats. They'll be like, well, you also don't have, you don't think your feet are too big? You're not quite a schizophrenic.
Right.
You have to go through, you have to like do right. like there'd be like 9 symptoms of schizophrenia, and you'd have to get like 5 to be then clinically schizophrenic.
For what you just described, I think they flip to the C's, and you're a cartoonist,
yes.
Which is kind of exciting. Turns out you're just really artistic.
That's the plots of the movie Harvey.
Yes, exactly.
Now, while the behavior of the vast majority of sadists are ultimately harmless, as they're usually able to confine their behavior to consensual experiences with other adults, when combined with antisocial personality disorder, sexual sadism can be responsible for almost unimaginable cruelty. Think BTK. Mm-hmm. BTK is a perfect example of a sexual sadist that also has antipersonality disorder. These people, it's pretty much any sort of conscience is wiped completely clean.
Right.
With them.
Well, that's the problem with even saying sadism is harmless is because it so quickly can escalate. Because you're basically looking at people that discover from a very young age, literally as young as 4 years old, that signs of pain make them sexually aroused. And once that starts, because think about this, it's been like, I used to use a normal, I guess, quote unquote normal, a cisgendered idea. This is fun. Is that a fun?
No, I hate the word. No, but it's fine. Go on.
But I, the first time I jerked off, it was to Jenny McCarthy. on a TV guide. And now I can walk past a TV guide without jerking off easy.
You know what's so amazing is that you were constantly making sigils and you didn't even know it because now you're on television.
Boom.
Boom. So you jerk off on a TV guide at a young age. 15, 20 years later, you get to have
a professional
some shows.
Television, right. Television comedian.
That's correct.
But the idea is that, like, so any normal human being, your fantasies escalate. So now it's just like, I like physical sex with a human being because that is what, like, my life.
But this is also, to your point about escalation, this is why people in the BDSM community have such strict rules.
Yeah.
For people that participate that don't know, you think it's all free, willy-nilly, and good times. It's actually very strict.
And someone that has an antisocial personality mixed with sadistic tendencies, like, the biggest problem is there's a documentary watch, I believe it's called Interview with a Sexual Sadist. Is that what it's called?
Actually, it's called Truth, Lies, and Sex Offenders and Sadistic versus Non-Sadistic Sex Offenders, created by Anna Salter.
And if you watch this, I mean, first of all, good luck trying to have sex afterwards.
Yeah, or during. I mean,
yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah. It's pretty intense, and we're going to show some clips from that. But these people literally have no empathy. They cannot feel empathy because the idea of empathy would disturb them getting a boner.
So the other thing about the sexual sadist is fantasy. Fantasy plays a gigantic part in sexual sadism. Most of them, the fantasy, it stops at pornography, writing sadistic stories, drawing sadistic type of situations, but some take it into the realm of rape and murder.
It's really interesting. Someone was talking about the natural escalation of sadism in a child, and they say the way they know it is that, like, you know, they would cry a lot as a baby, and then obviously when a baby's, like, crying for attention, it was like this weird thing where they would pick up the baby a lot, and it would start like that, and it would all of a sudden just stop crying and just eerily stare at you. And then the other thing is stuff like watching kids draw on, like, pictures of nude women that they would show them. It's like once they started, like in juvenile centers, like kids that were convicted of violent crimes, they were giving them pictures of women, like either like women or men, and be like, you know, draw how you feel, like how you like, you know, like what do these make you feel? And they would draw a woman covered in chains wrapped around her ankles and her like wrists and shit like that. It starts at like 6.
53% of males who are sexual sadists, they report an interest in sexual sadism before the act of 15. It definitely comes on very early. And then once the sexual sadist has crossed the line from just fantasy into rape and or murder, it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, for them to stop, and it only increases. We have a sound clip here from a professed sexual sadist pedophile. He's going to talk to us about escalation. And a warning, this is extremely rough.
I have been fantasizing about killing a victim during the course of rape or molest. About 5 or 6 months. All during the course of the molestation of my stepson when I was using the Ziploc, the plastic bag over his head. I had fantasized and thought about killing him, letting him go ahead and suffocate during the process of the molestation. I believe it would have been maybe as short as another month or two, and I would have actually killed him if I was not arrested.
And I was just sad that my dad didn't come to my baseball game.
Right. Yeah.
That is rough. It's rough to joke about.
It's very rough to joke about. I mean, this guy, if you watch the full interview with him, it's about 10 minutes long. He talks about he had over 300 victims.
Yes. He is truly a monster. And then you also, like, the way he talks, too, which is very chilling, is how distanced he has made himself from his crimes. And when he's talked about what he did to his stepson, it's absolutely mind-boggling. It's so cruel. It's horrifying.
Oh.
And we're going to see the same train of thought in Dean Corll, which is why we wanted to start here. Because Marcus and I were talking for a while about, like Dean Corll is now a prototype of a type of killer. Like we see with John Wayne Gacy, we see it's like these boy killers, these guys that like kill for the rush of it.
Because
that's what they describe in this interview. and other interviews with other pedophiles and sadistic sexual criminals in that interview, they talk about the buzz they get from doing the action is something that they can't replace with drugs. And we were like, why would Dean Corll do it?
As far as the escalation goes, Dean Corll is very similar, or at least one investigator believes that Dean Corll is very similar to John Wayne Gacy, because John Wayne Gacy, as we know, pretty much accidentally killed a boy. And with Dean Corll, one investigator believes that Dean Corll's first murder was probably a cover-up, because a lot of pedophiles, they tend to take great care to not make any sort of physical mark upon the victim.
Because there's also two different types of the sexual offender when it comes to pedophilia, which is sadistic and non-sadistic. The non-sadistic, a lot of times, believes, because it comes from a chain of molesting, they've been molested as to children, and they believe that's the only way that was the only time they ever received love.
Right.
And so they view their act as an act of love, where a sadistic criminal like Dean Corll believes that it's the pain is what they're going for.
Right, but they can also eventually justify themselves by saying that the pain is what the kids want.
Yes.
Like, they can eventually get to a point where they have to lie to themselves so much to be able to still do this that they have to say, it's like, well, he's not really screaming.
Yeah.
Like, he's screaming, but it's not really hurting him.
It's like going to the gym.
Yeah, or giving a kid black licorice when they look disgusted and sad, but you're like, they love it. It's really sweet. They can't get enough of black licorice. Sure.
Do this?
No, I don't do any of this.
Well, what they think is that possibly Dean, every time he was molesting boys, and we know that he was molesting boys all throughout, and each time these sadistic urges were getting bigger and stronger every single time he was doing it. And one time he possibly went too far, left a noticeable mark, killed the boy to hide the crime, and found out that not only did he very much like it, but he got away with it.
Yes, exactly. And then what we always talk about with every serial killer is that now all of the permissions that he had built into his life to then just force himself into being a serial killer allowed him to do it. And then he finally was just like, okay, now I can finally be me.
Yeah.
Now that I've honed my voice.
Right. He can go direct the next X-Men movie.
Yes.
Hollywood will love him. That's where Dean Corll should have gone.
Now let's get back to Dean Corll's story. And now is when we're going to bring in Dean Corll's second and much more valuable accomplice, Wayne Henley, or Elmer Wayne Henley Jr., if you want to get real technical.
He doesn't like the Elmer. He doesn't. He cut the Elmer afterwards.
I'm going to say he made the right choice.
Wayne Henley's a much better stage name.
Wayne Henley sounds like you're in a band. You have wavy hair. You constantly drive in a Corvette. Elmer Wayne Henley?
Sounds like an accomplice to a child murder.
Or a pig in the backseat. Literally not even a person.
No, Wayne, he was originally supposed to be a victim. David Brooks, who you'll remember from the last episode as Dean Corll's first accomplice, had been friends with Wayne for years, and Wayne fit the victim profile to a T.
Buck teeth, rangy, wearing Wranglers.
Uh-huh.
He had long blonde hair, which is true, and then a happy trail.
Kind of looked like Mitch Hedberg, huh?
Yes.
Now, Wayne Henley, early life was rough, but not the worst that we've ever covered. His mother was strict, but not unreasonably so. His father was an abusive drunk, but not that abusive. And the father left when Wayne was in junior high. He also got in trouble with the law here and there. He had a breaking and entering charge along with assault with a deadly weapon. And like a lot of other serial killers, like Jeffrey Dahmer, Wayne was pretty hardcore alcoholic, hardcore teenage alcoholic. But unlike most of them, Wayne was extremely popular, which made him just the absolute perfect accomplice for Dean.
Because you remember how we described Houston last time as just being there was roving gangs of kids everywhere, just kind of hanging out. And Wayne was the kind of guy that could travel between a bunch of different packs of kids. And he knew everybody.
And being a raging alcoholic in Texas as a youth, you're just a Texas youth, right? I mean, he didn't stand out as the particular. He wasn't the most drunk one at the party.
Well, that's what the Hillegeist family said that's how they noticed Wayne Henley walking around. It said he was always drunkenly kind of wandering back and forth between houses, going "Hi, Mrs. Hillegeist, I hope you're having a good day." And it's just that was his hobby.
was drunkenly swaying.
Well, and that's
down
why
the street.
That's why what Dean Corll did is actually quite remarkable, because it's extremely difficult to kill and shoot people in Texas because they're always zigzagging.
Yes.
So it's tough. It's tough to hit them.
Now, even though David was bringing in victims here and there for Dean Corll, the problem with David is that most people didn't really like him. Like, this is what one fellow teenager said about David Brooks.
He wasn't somebody we hung around with or wanted to hang around with. He wasn't all that nice. He didn't talk that much. You'd just see him driving around the neighborhood in his vet. He never had huffing gas.
Oh, man, what a loser.
And a huff of gas is easy to get. You can get it anywhere. I could stick my head underneath the muffler of a car as it's just idling, and I got high as a biscuit.
And biscuits get pretty high in Texas.
If it's in a crow's mouth. Anyways, I better get back to huffing this gas.
If it's in a crow's mouth, that's just what they say.
Well.
Stop masturbating, please.
Well, not only was Brooks pretty unpopular, he was also kind of an outsider in the Heights, especially compared to Wayne Henley, who had lived in the Heights his entire life. Wayne Henley was trusted. He was a known quantity. Yeah, he was the type of guy who hung out in the parking lot of Long John Silver's a lot.
And this is when Long John Silver's was like a real restaurant, like Wendy's used to be back in the day.
Oh, Wendy's still is, my friend. And we will. That's the most controversial thing that's ever been said on this show. I will defend Wendy's until the day I'm 6 feet under.
And Wayne, he also wasn't the typical, like, he was a nice guy but quiet type like Dean was. He was gregarious. He was popular. He was friends with absolutely everybody. And most importantly, he liked to party.
He was the guy who did a lot of, like, woo!
Yeah! Woo! Yeah! Woo!
Woo! They're like, that Wayne's a good guy.
Nice, fun guy.
Now, it may not come as a surprise that the kids in the Heights in the early 70s liked to get a little high, and if they had their druthers, they'd go for weed, beer, and lewds, but Police Chief Herman Short was, of course, having none of that, because instead of investing any resources whatsoever into searching for the missing children, which by this point had gotten to be, I'd say, a baker's dozen, or spending any actual time investigating the hundreds of murders that they knew for a fact were happening in the city, Herman Short decided that drug offenses needed to be Houston's top priority.
And you want to know, to be honest, when I look at it, it's mostly it's just because it is the easiest way to bust black people and hippies.
Absolutely.
It's like, yeah, and that's what they wanted to do all
and
the time.
A lot of these municipalities, we've talked about it in previous episodes, the cops are an extension of the tax man.
Yeah.
So if you want to make some money for your local precincts and your local community, you just small drug offenses are the way to do it.
And it's also getting votes as well, because you can actually, because busting people for weed and pills is extremely easy.
Right.
But solving a murder is pretty fucking hard.
If you pat down one out of every three people, you're going to find something illegal on them.
Yes. Yeah.
For sure. Especially in the Heights in Texas.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what one teenager said about the mood at the time with the cops.
Jeez Christ, you rob a bank or beat up an old lady, but if you looked like you were holding dope, it was your ass.
Yeah. And I know exactly what that's like. Yeah.
Beating up an old lady or robbing banks? Which one?
Well, no, just being able to fuck up and do anything that you really want, but for some reason, holding a fucking dime bag was the worst possible thing you could do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was in Florida when I would drive back and forth. I had a girlfriend in Atlanta, and I would drive from Tallahassee to Atlanta, and I had long hair and a beard, like, down to my chest. Like, it was, like, it was fucking, it was awesome. I was awesome.
You were morbidly obese.
Yes.
I think you're trying to paint a different picture.
I think so.
I was wearing a dashiki.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and when you were doing the hand motions to say how big your beard was, I thought you were going to say I had these huge tits.
I did have huge old fucking Pamela's down there. And I was trying. But nice. The cops would pull me over, and like, this is Georgia. You get to a point being like, you know, it's just like the as soon as they see that you have long hair, they would go through the whole car for weed.
Yeah.
I would like sit there and wait as they check for weed, because that's all I wanted to get.
Yeah.
It also sounds like a Twilight Zone episode where you get pulled over. You're like, thank God I'm white. You look in your rearview mirror, you're black.
What?
Oh my God.
So these kids, instead of just smoking weed and getting groovy, they turn to the last refuge of teenagers in towns with strict drug enforcement. And I will attest to this, huffing paint.
Mm.
when kids can't get fucked up, when they can't get to weed or beer, at least way back in the day, I don't think paint huffing is that big of a...
No, it does not go away. Yeah. Huffing does not go away. Everybody huffs.
I am fairly certain huffing is the only reason that Cops is still on the air. Yes. If you ever see an episode where officers arrest somebody who's been huffing paint, it's one of the most phenomenal things you'll ever see.
The tube top is still worn. And I feel huffing paint has a lot to do with that. And I did Whippets like a year ago.
Oh, yeah. No, we bought so many crackers and things like that to make Whippets.
Well, I think they were in the 70s a little... Like, the social stigma of huff and paint wasn't quite there just
yet. Yes, now it's for the true fucking bottomed-out loser.
For botten, you might say.
Yes.
But this is what one kid said about paint huffing.
You spray the can in the paper bag, and you stick your nose in and huff a few times, and everything's different. You talk funny, you don't know where you're at. Sometimes you hear voices that ain't talking. And when you wake up, you huff again, and you can keep all night. One of my friends huffed for a whole day and night, and he wasn't hurt a bit. But a 12-year-old kid did some Krylix and ran around trying to play football, collapsed, and he died. Mm. I guess you can get too much of anything.
Even too much of huffing paint and playing football.
Yeah, and I was like, I can't believe there's a ceiling to this because it just seems like the good times never end, everybody.
May I ask, who won the game?
What game?
The football. Never mind.
Now, Wayne Henley, he was supposed to be a victim, you know, of Dean Corll.
Right.
But when Dean Corll met him, he immediately saw an opportunity here. He immediately saw him like, okay, now this David Brooks kid is okay, but this Wayne Henley, this is the perfect accomplice for me.
Was it a lack of sexual attraction to the kid?
No. Absolutely he wanted nothing. To fuck Wayne Henley and probably tried to.
Okay.
David Brooks had a more straight up sexual relationship with Dean Corll. David Brooks was with that. What Wayne had even said about David Brooks was that he was playing gay for pay for Dean Corll. Like Dean Corll was paying a little bit. They were kind of fooling around. Wayne Henley got brought in to be one of their sex partners. He said no to that. I just like to party. Eventually, he kept showing up. So Dean Corll was hanging out with David Brooks, and Wayne Henley would kind of hang around because they had weed and booze, and they had the pool table, and they had the boys' club hanging out, and he would be there a lot. Now, what we're going to see here is the classic sort of grooming phase, but what I'm going to posit, and what we're going to talk about next episode even more so, is how a pedophile murderer, someone like John Wayne Gacy, like how Dean Corll does it, grooms his accomplice as well. Basically, he looked through a sea of people and had learned how to look for the exact traits that he needed, which is somebody with literally nothing to lose, who was a complete and total burnout, that would go ahead and find him a boy for $200.
Every time you said the word groom, I couldn't help but think of how cute a Pomeranian looks with a puppy cut.
You'd be bad in the FBI.
Yeah, very bad.
Well, I've actually got a sound clip here from an interview with Wayne Henley talking about the exact nature of his relationship with Dean Corll.
What did he want you to do?
He wanted to pay me to find people and bring them to him. And help him do his thing. And kill him and help him bury him.
Did you go pay him? He was going to pay you. How much would he pay you per person?
I don't know. He said $1,500 once.
$1,500 a person.
He talks about it like it's boring.
He has no feelings.
Well, if you actually see the video clip, he's in the back of a police car with his face in his hands holding a cigarette.
Right, yes.
Yeah, I mean, the actual context of it is a little different, and it's very soon after he got caught.
And, of course, he's holding a Marlboro because Big Tobacco never fails
big
to
tobacco
seize an opportunity
is the
to
problem.
Advertise.
This is what I'm saying.
Think about
Jesus, yeah. It's once they switch from girls in bikinis with beach balls, and all of a sudden you have snarled loners smoking cigarettes because they're like, let's play to the audience that loves us.
That's right. That was a specific to the Texas audience.
Well, Wayne Henley said that he held off on saying yes to Dean Corll for, I mean, he said he goes between saying he held off for a month to saying that he held off for a year. But in reality, it's more likely for about a month. He's like, I don't think I'm going to bring this guy kids for about $1,500.
But it's because the problem is that if he had said no, but we now know that if he had said no, Dean Corll would have killed him.
Yeah, Dean Corll definitely would. And there's no telling how many kids that Dean Corll made this offer to before Wayne Henley finally said yes.
And what you're going to look at, this is just sort of him letting out the line. Mm-hmm. He was just letting out the line, letting Wayne kind of figure out, but he was definitely going to kill him either way. Like, he was Wayne Henley was going to end up in the fucking boat shed.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give him too much credit for willpower. You know, most people go 90 years with never delivering a child to a sexual sadist who will then have sex with them or sell them into a sex ring, whatever. Most people just die without doing that.
Different strokes for different folks.
Oh, I see. That's
everybody's got a hustle, Ben.
Okay.
Now,
so
I think he was only looking for an excuse, and about a month later, he got that excuse because Wayne Henley, like I said earlier, his stepfather left, and so he had a mom, he had two brothers, and of course his mother couldn't support all of these kids on her meager salary. So Wayne Henley finally had the excuse, I can bring this guy boys and I can make money for my family.
But I will also say that is a part of what shows Wayne Henley's true colors, as I think it's exactly the things he gave himself permission.
Yeah. Right,
and up until at this point is that he had done this, he gave Wayne Henley the same spiel that he gave Brooks, where he said, we're running heists. So at first they broke into a couple places and stole some things. And then he said, actually I work for this pedophile ring. I work for this child slavery ring. Yeah. And he was like, okay, kind of like slowly accepting it until finally he was like, no, I kill him.
Right.
No, I just kill him. And then you have to, then it's yours too late.
Yeah. Wayne Henley's first lure for Dean Corll was 17-year-old Willard Branch. Wayne said that he and Corll picked up the boy and took him back to Coral's apartment under the guise of all of them getting a little baked for the evening.
Think about how much fun that could have been.
Yeah, just getting stoned with a bunch of psychopaths?
Yeah, just Dean Corll just fucking wavering and staring at you the whole time like you're a fucking lamb flank.
Right.
Yum, yum, yum. Always going like yum, yum and accidentally spilling like a spice thing on you. Man, go, uh-oh. Better get some of that off. You don't want you smelling like a Thanksgiving dinner, you know?
That's right.
And after everyone got super high, Corll and Henley, playing out a plan that had been devised beforehand, tricked the boy into putting handcuffs on himself.
So John Wayne Gacy. It's the rope trick.
Yeah, and both Dean Corll and Wayne Henley, their little trick was that they had hidden the key in their pocket. So they both went like, hey, look, this handcuff trick. Oh, my God, I can get out. Both of them did. And this kid's like, yeah, man, I can fucking do that. I can get out of them. Let me try.
Oh, man, I'm stuck. Weird. Guys, did you... Oh, that's a cool-looking sled.
It is. You know, I gotta say, other than what happens next, it is fun to do when you're stoned.
We did that. We've played with handcuffs stoned and walking around, but that's also three consenting adults doing it together, having a good time doing it.
Not about to murder or one another.
No,
or
just having a good laugh.
Yeah.
You remember that one night, and then we played with handcuffs, and then we did Bloody Mary? We were like blackout drunk, and then the buddy Keith came over, and then he passed out in the kitchen, and now he's a physicist.
By definition, because we were blackout drunk, I do not remember. But I think that's a good thing.
So this kid, once he was restrained, he was dragged back to Dean Corll's room as Wayne walked out the door. Wayne returned the next day, where Corll, as promised, gave Wayne $200 for his services and once again assured him,
no,
I did not murder that boy.
No, I did not murder the boy. Actually, you just missed the sex slave guys.
Is that right?
Here. And Barney's hilarious. I wish you could. He was telling me this funny story about how this kid was trying to get out of the van, and so he went around him and just fucking shocked him with a cattle prod like you do, you know?
Yeah.
And then he died of a fucking heart attack right in the van. I was like, get the fuck out of here. This guy.
I was here the whole time. But I didn't.
Hey, have you seen my sled? I got this.
Oh, is that right? Oh, isn't that something? Any more weed around?
So Henley's next lure would be an actual friend of his from Long John Silver's, a teenager named Frank Aguirre. And after Frank's late night shift at Long John Silver's ended one night, Henley convinced him to come back to Dean's to get a little bit wasted. And Frank trusted his friend and, like the boy before, also got locked into the handcuffs. And Henley claims that at this point he had second thoughts about, you know, selling his lifelong friend into sex slavery.
Right. Weird. Yeah. That seems crazy. At this point, you're just being like, you know, just you have a job now, Wayne.
Right. And the guy who was in the handcuffs was having second thoughts about his career at Long John Silver's.
Yeah, yeah,
so
exactly.
Everyone was overthinking it.
Yeah, Frank was really sick of doing the upsell, telling like, well, if you're going to get the fried cod, then you might as well get the popcorn shrimp.
Why wouldn't you?
It's, everybody's got different problems at their job.
That's right.
So Henley, he said that he tried to convince Coral to not sell the boy into the sex slavery ring, and this is when Coral decided that it was a good time to tell Wayne that actually, you know what, there actually is no boy slavery wing. I'm totally killing these boys, and also, by the way, I also killed that other lifelong friend of yours that went missing last year.
And Wayne right. said, huh.
Isn't that something?
Whoa.
No shit!
So you mean I've been hoodwinked? No was, way.
Yeah.
No, and it's true, but then Frank Aguirre, when he, I keep calling it, it's Aguirre. Aguirre makes, it sounds like that the Werner Herzog movie, which is pretty fucking
sounds
sweet.
Sounds like a knife that they sell you on QVC that's sharp, that can cut through it's a got hammer and a really cold steak.
It's got a titanium blade for maximum stopping power.
Wow.
But he is, it's very interesting how when Frank Aguirre went missing, they were like, there's no way he's going to be gone because, number one, he's like a buddy of him owed him $10
right.
straight up. And they're like, and Frank's one to never forget alone.
Yeah.
And then also he had a check waiting for him at Long John Silver's. And he also had a beautiful girlfriend, Rhonda, that was waiting for him to ask her to marry him.
Yeah. And wow. he also left his Rambler, his Dodge Rambler, in the parking lot of Long John Silver's.
So I think we can all agree the big winner of the story, Rhonda. Holy hell. What kind of life would that have been?
But we're going to find out that Rhonda didn't exactly win in this scenario because
right.
sometimes a good way to get a girlfriend is to kill the boyfriend of the girl that you want to date.
I've seen that. I've heard
yes.
of that before. It yeah. was in The Pickup Artist,
Absolutely.
Wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is also, but actually at this time, for some reason, it was revealed, like, not only did he kill Frank Aguirre, not only did I kill that boy before, I also killed David Hillegeist as well. Wayne didn't go to the police. At all. He didn't tell anybody about this. According to Wayne, he quote-unquote really hit it off with Dean because he said that Dean was clean-cut, he was smart, he was nicely dressed. He said that Dean listened to him, explained things to him, and he would stay completely loyal for another year until Dean's death.
Now, this is the other thing, too, is that I, on Lost Podcast on the Left, I think we always talk about this. None of us believe in Svengalis.
No.
I don't believe that somebody can have such a mystical power over somebody that they would never betray them. I think Wayne Henley was in there because he finally had the permission to be the career criminal that he always wanted to be. And now he's like a real Texas outlaw. Like, you get to go and you're roving in this pack of dudes that have like a secret. And he's also never had a real father. Like, his father beat the shit out of him. So he only has his dad he can like, that he can be his henchman to. And he likes being a henchman because he gets all the booze and weed that he wants. And he gets to go around and kind of hold this thing over the head over everybody in town. He's somebody special now.
Mm-hmm. I do like the booze and weed part, but I think if Dean would have taught him how to install shower curtain rings, he also would have done that for a living.
Yes.
Like, don't this you is, think?
Yes.
Like, Dean had a lot of power.
He needed a father figure.
Right. So, but Dean could have not let him into the child murder
thing.
Yeah,
exactly. He could have taught him how to make pralines.
Oh, great. I love a good praline.
Absolutely. He could have taught him how to make chainsaw ice sculptures out in the middle of Montana. That would have been lovely.
You know, a lot of snow in Texas.
Custom furniture.
Yeah.
Anything else.
There's a lot of options here besides boy murder. Rape.
Most other, yeah. yeah pretty yeah, much yeah. anything else.
There's a lot of options. Yeah. Always remember that. If you think you have no other option but boy murder, you can do, get into hosting a podcast.
Boom. Why not?
Now, around the time that Wayne Henley was added to the duo of Brooks and Coral, Dean turned 30 years old. And Dean had a bit of a quarter-life crisis.
Oh, this is a thing that we don't really talk about with Dean Coral because there's not much known really about him because he died before he was even convicted of any of these crimes. We talk about these crimes. But that was a thing that was very interesting. He was very concerned with his age.
Yeah.
And how he looked and how he dressed. And he was always talking with Wayne and Brooks about, like, do I look old? Like, how do I look? He was, like, obsessed with being a child. That's a part of the pedophile
mentality is that you also view yourself, because your sexuality stopped when, like, Michael Jackson, we're not going to do this again.
No,
Michael
Jackson wasn't a pedophile.
He enjoyed kids a lot.
Yeah, I mean,
he wanted to show them the childhood he never had. We're not doing it.
Yeah,
we're
stuffed toy group.
Yeah, I mean,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, right. I mean, he was like a close friend of him.
He
know?
Had a pet monkey that he put a diaper on and he hung out with all day long.
Bubbles, the monkey?
Yes.
Bubbles was a friend.
He went to the Grammys with Bubbles.
He had a carousel with his face on all the horses.
Oh, right.
But Dean Corll views himself almost as a young kid. It's like a 15, 16-year-old kid.
Right, exactly.
And the hitting 30 was a big thing. It was a big thing for all of us.
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
And the only, in fact, the only thing that you never, never mentioned when you were hanging out with Dean Corll, you never mentioned his age, and you never mentioned trombones.
Ooh, I'm mad just thinking about trombones myself, and I never.
Why?
I'm just, trombones make me mad.
What's wrong with the trombone? They got puffy ear or puffy cheeks coming out of them and everything.
I think it's a dumb instrument.
Oh, no. It's not a dumb instrument. It's a big band instrument.
All the only thing can do is appropriately is the sounds of erections going up and going down.
That's all you need.
That is all it can do. It's a slide whistle. It is a glorified slide whistle.
I love trombones.
Everyone loves trombones.
But the reason why he hated it, you know, because kids would give him shit because that's all he did in high school, remember? All he did was make pralines, make squirrel jewelry, and play the trombone all day long.
All day fucking long. Candy and trombones.
Which is very easy to make fun of.
Yeah.
So after 30, Corll withdrew almost completely from the adult world. He only interacted with people other than teenagers when he was at work, and even the people that he worked with didn't have a hell of a whole lot to say about him. The most one of them had to say about him was, now I know where a lot of our nylon cord went.
That's really funny, Daniel. Now will you please get back to stocking those shelves?
That's a good Texas joke.
And the only other thing that stuck out in their mind was a conversation that that same employee had had with Dean about the war. And when the conversation turned toward the act of killing an enemy, Dean said,
"Want to kill one, the rest come easy."
Is that what Dean sounded like? I don't think that's what Dean Corll sounded like.
I just imagine with, like, you know, like a curly Q, like, hairstyle in the front of him, like a weird curl plaster to his forehead.
Yeah.
Well, that was the thing. I think someone posted on the Facebook page being like, Dean Corll's kind of hot. It's like, no, he didn't. He had like a skeleton-like stare. Like, he couldn't blink.
No, he's not hot. There's nothing hot about Dean Corll.
No, he was absolutely terrible.
But yeah, he talked about killing all the time, but he served in Vietnam, and he didn't do a goddamn thing in Vietnam.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was talking about killing boys, but the coworker assumed that he was talking about Vietnam. But outside of work, Dean's entire world revolved around Wayne and David. One boy said,
"Nobody ever knew him except David and Wayne. Nobody ever talked about him or asked about him. No one ever would ever say, oh, have you seen Dean lately? Because Dean didn't matter." Hmm. And that's a really interesting thing when the man with the candy also said, with the three of them together, is that it was what's three multiplied by zero?
Yeah.
It was three zeros. It was three people that kind of flitted in and out of society. And it's also very interesting because Dean Corll's behavior sort of reminds me of been to like a like a club. It's like that kind of
no, never have.
But you know what I mean? Like when you go to a club and you go and there's like a guy sitting on the back in like sunglasses that nobody knows, but then for some reason it's like it's all in his dime. Like when you hang out with like actors and shit, they're like, "Oh, that's McGuire over there," but like, "Don't talk to McGuire." And I'm just like, "Well, what does McGuire do?" And he's just like, "He does."
Yeah. He slips out the back door without paying the bill.
But he's like paying for everything. He's one of those guys. He fancied himself now like a party host, kind of. And he would come and mix various people together like it was the fucking Andy Warhol's factory. And he would stimulate conversation. But really, he was making a rape thing.
Well, that was the thing about Dean is that no one even said that Dean was enigmatic.
No.
Like, no one, absolutely no one even cared about him. To the point where Dean, Wayne, and David, they would spend their afternoons going to Long John Silver's, hanging out with all the junior high kids. And they would only hang out with the junior high kids.
That's gotta be creepy as fuck.
Were there any other restaurants?
Yeah, that was a fried chicken place.
Oh, okay.
The Long John Silver's is the nice one with the booths.
Oh, I see. With the springs in the seats and things.
And Jack Olson, again, from The Man with the Candy, he put it absolutely perfectly. He said, "To most people in the Heights, the odd trio was seen only as a hawk is sometimes seen in the woods. a quick silhouette or a subliminal shadow swiftly passed.
But it also illustrates something about young guys, right? They were just going to where the party was. They're going where the booze and weed was. They didn't care who was fucking throwing the party. They were showing up because they heard there was a guy that had a fucking pool table and probably as many pralines as you could stomach.
So many pralines.
And
yeah.
like weed and huff and paint and all this stuff that you like, he's got, and you just show up and use it. They were just using him, but they didn't know that it was a gigantic honey trap.
And then there was a room that just was full of trombones, and if you paid $2, you got to go destroy all of them.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun.
I mean, the phrase that just kept coming up again and again when they asked these kids about Coral and Henley and Brooks, they kept saying, who gives a shit? You know, because they'd say that they'd be hanging out, and Dean would, he'd only talk to Wayne and David, and he'd say some sort of weird cryptic remark.
Huh,
and
that reminds me of that one time I raped that boy.
Was it?
And they all be like, ha ha ha, like laughing like it's a joke. And they're like, huh. Anyways, like back to just being like, oh, MASH is on.
And they would just, you know, they'd only talk to each other. And these kids, you know, they'd say like, who gives a shit? And mostly they didn't give a shit was because they threw these sick ass parties that everyone had a good time at. And they also, they had varying degrees of partying. They had pretty much two different kinds of partying. There was the 12 to 14 party that was candies and sodas.
So they had the little X on their hands.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, the straight edge parties.
Right.
But once the kids hit 15, it was grass, pills, booze, glue, and paint. It was the absolute perfect trap, but not all the boys were invited. Close friends of Wayne, who'd known him for his entire life, were almost never invited. And in fact, the parties were mostly populated by boys that they hardly knew. But again, as the same kid said, who gives a shit?
It's really true. Now, I remember this one quote from the man with the candy. He was like, yeah, it's like Wayne was always talking about these parties. He had all free booze and weed stuff. He's like, he never invited me, but I could throw the same kind of party in the back of my car. He literally was just as content. And I almost envy that. Being like, you could go and have a great time just getting hammered in the back of a car back in the day.
No, it's not that great a time. That was how my high school was. It wasn't that great of a time.
You enjoy yourself?
No, you would party in the back, and then you would open up the back door, walk to the front, and be like, that was a hell of a party.
Ooh, hell yeah, right? Or let's go home.
Thank God that one's over.
Hey, let me take those keys from you. I don't think you're a little bit too drunk to drive. And it's just like, Donald, you don't have any shoes on, and you're fucking, and your shirt's in tatters. So it's like, you know what? You better take the keys. I'm too drunk to drive.
High school, huh?
So more and more kids are disappearing, and some people are starting to notice. And I think what this is that I think, you know, Wayne Henley was in these groups of kids, and they're like, hey, Frank, where the fuck did Frank go? You know, Dave, where the fuck did Dave go?
Right.
And so what they got these kids to start doing, it was the same technique that Leonard Lake and Charles Ng used, where they got these kids to write letters to their parents.
And I have an example of one of the letters that I will read. Mom, I'm sorry I left like I did, but I got a better job working on a truck loading and unloading from Houston to Washington. We should be back within 3 or 4 weeks. I'll either call you or see you then. Love, Johnny.
I mean, what was he doing before, if that's the better job?
Long John Silver.
Oh, I see. Oh, that is a better job.
But
the
shit, it's like it wouldn't work out because it would sound like out of character for the person writing the letter.
Totally forced. The handwriting would a lot of times be really shaky and weird.
That's what they say. They were like, it didn't look like my son's writing. And then one father's been like, No. They never hire somebody to unload and load a truck. It's like there are unloaders and there are loaders.
And then there are drivers. You don't take your loader and unloader from, you know, Washington, D.C. back to Houston.
Like, that
you
don't make truck sense.
It doesn't.
And I know truck logic. All right, you keep a hamburger in the glove compartment in case you need to distract a dog. You keep a gun in your shoe in case you're getting raped next to a highway. And you always keep a mannequin head in the passenger seat so you can kiss it when you miss your wife.
That is kind of nice to do, isn't it?
Yeah. So what happened with this letter writing is that it really actually did work as far as, you know, setting the law off of the trail of Dean Corll and Wayne Henley. Because this one family, their son was gone for about a week. They called up the Houston PD and reported him missing. And when they got this letter in, they're like, this letter is, you know, this is absolutely like, this doesn't sound like him at all. Let's take this to the police as evidence that he, something fishy's going on here. But the police, when the family talked to missing persons, they said, oh, you've heard from him? Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're going to take him off the missing persons list.
So that didn't work at all.
Opposite effect. As far as murder method went, some boys were strangled, others were shot, some got both. One kid was shot in the chest and left to bleed to death in Dean's bathtub. Another got a bullet in the head from Wayne that entered his forehead and came out his ear. The boy survived and came to a few minutes later and was only able to get out the words, Wayne, please don't. And that was before Wayne and Dean strangled him to death together. Another boy was accidentally shot in the jaw and bled out all day as he was tortured before Dean finally strangled him to death.
Well, that was a very interesting thing, too. Brooks talked about that specific murder where Wayne didn't mean to shoot him, where Wayne came in and was fucking around with a gun, like, laughing and yelling. They were, like, joking around with each other in front of two guys. They're all tied up, and the gun just went off and blew the guy's jaw off, which really must have distracted Dean Corll, because he's like, I can't rape this boy. He looks like Gina Davis from Beetlejuice.
Yeah, I guess that's sort of a workplace accident where you're in the child killing business.
Well, one boy, Mark Scott, tried to fight back, and with one arm tied behind his back, he grabbed a knife and swung it at Dean. He barely broke the skin. He almost got him, but that was before Wayne pointed a pistol in his face. Mark gave up, dropped the knife, and was immediately choked to death by Dean. And this right here is very telling, because you'd think that the kid who tried to fight back, the kid who showed some resistance, you'd think that Dean would take pleasure in torturing that boy in particular. But rather, he was the only boy that Wayne killed immediately torturing.
It's very interesting with Dean Corll, because Wayne says this after the fact, which you're going to hear now some details about the torture, which are pretty fucking rough. But Dean Corll, apparently when he was doing these actions, he would literally be like, I love you. He loved these boys for allowing him to get these impulses out of him. It was very upsetting.
The more he liked the boy, the longer the boy stayed alive.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So like a kid would be like, I'm really happy I ate that last sandwich or drank his last beer, because now I'm going to die in 4 hours, as opposed to the kid who let it be in the fridge.
Always be sassy to a guy holding a party, because when he's going to kill him. It's just like, that's me. It's just like, I make a lot of friends really easily. Man, I wouldn't want to have been on that sled.
You'd be seven days they would have kept you alive. Pee in a potted plant or something immediately.
You make them laugh, though, and then you'll become an assistant.
Yeah.
Well, one kid, actually, he almost escaped through a kind gesture by David, who was like, hey, guy, why don't we get you out of here? Why don't we take you home? But the kid, when David was about to drop him off at his house, he wouldn't get out of the car. Mm. He said, no, man,
I want to keep partying, man.
Let's go back to Dean's. And finally, David Brooks was like, fuck it. All right. He took him back, and Dean killed him.
Oh, my
God. It's always leave earlier than you think.
Yep.
That's the other thing, too. You don't always have to be the last guy at the party. No. That's what I'd also say. It's sometimes cool to leave early.
Yeah.
Because it shows you got other things to do, and also sometimes you don't get tortured to death.
Right. I think the last guy at all these parties was never left. They just never left.
Yeah.
They stayed there forever.
Yeah. Now, the method of ending the life that these people used was fairly standard, strangle or shoot, but the methods of torture varied wildly. When police searched Dean's house, the first thing they found was an 18-inch double dildo. They also found extremely thin glass rods that Corll had stolen from Houston Power and Lighting. Wayne said that Dean would shove them in his victims' urethras and snap them off inside.
Ugh.
He would also pull out pubic hairs either with his fingers or pliers, and perhaps most disturbingly, he chewed off the genitals of one boy who had made him particularly angry. And police said when they found the actual penis and balls in the mass grave, they could tell that it had been ripped off in one.
Now, do you think that then the police officer then turned to the other guy and said, like, that guy should have had a Snickers?
Yeah, I think that was right. He was actually Marilyn Monroe, but he was cranky.
That's rough.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's how, think about how mad you have to be. I mean, like,
to gnaw off a boy's genitals?
You know when I could see it? Have you ever been on the bank? Like, on the phone of the bank, and then you know that they're fucking with you at the computer, and they know, you know, they just have to press a couple of buttons, and they could get rid of all your debt, or they could really fix your problem, like they put a hold in your card for some reason. You know they just have to go Control-Alt-Delete, and then all of a sudden your problems are over.
So the thing that gets you upset enough to gnaw off the genitals of a boy is a mundane activity that all of us go through.
Inconvenient customer right. service calls.
That's it.
That's it.
Everyone goes through that.
Otherwise, I'm easy breezy.
Okay.
Now, the victim's mouths were usually taped, but Dean would sometimes blast his radio to drown out any sounds that might be made in the commission of his crimes. In case you're curious, the biggest hits of 1973 included Crocodile Rock by Elton John, Frankenstein by the Edgar Winter Group, and the surprise return of the Monster Mash to the top of the charts and June of 1973.
The last one kind of fits to the theme, I guess.
But can you imagine just being next door to Dean and hearing, like, who did the mash?
Who did the moss?
Like, oh, they have some kind of Halloween party earlier over there. Hey, Jessica, let's get our vampire costumes and go over there to hang out. I like an early Halloween party.
Now, if you're wondering how so many boys could possibly enter one single house, never to exit again, well, the reason why none of this stuff really ever came out and why nobody ever thought anything about Dean, why he had no police record whatsoever, he moved constantly. He averaged 5 to 6 addresses per year from 1968 to 1973. But some of these apartments did have a couple of warning signs. One apartment had 4 bullet holes in the front door, which the maintenance man repaired without question.
Yeah, that's a Texas doorknob, isn't it?
Honestly, though, it seems like, of all places, Texas, that would be easily explainable.
I totally agree. Yeah,
I mean, more than most, especially in Houston, with one of the highest gun ownership rates in the nation at the time.
Yeah.
And a neighbor at a different house, he noticed that Dean spent a lot of time on his balcony with his binoculars watching children in the neighborhood. The same neighbor also once watched as Dean Corll, David Brooks, and Wayne Henley danced around in the parking lot with a boa constrictor, taking turns kissing it.
That must have been fun. And, you know, but neighbors said they were watching them do this stuff, and they're like, you know, I just kind of, they assumed that they all lived together. Mm-hmm. It's like, I just kind of assumed they all kind of were a bunch of boys, a bunch of roommates, like, living together. And it's like, and I didn't really think anything was weird until they started kissing snakes.
Yeah.
And that was pretty damn queer.
The boa constrictor, that's not the strangest thing they've done, not by far.
No, they killed a bunch of boys.
Right. Yeah, that's the part that really gets me going.
Yeah, that's the weird stuff.
If they stopped at the boa constrictor, I think they're a fairly fun, loving group of friends.
Yeah, if they were a boa constrictor, then they're just a step away from the guy with the mesh shirt with the trench lawn. It down on Coney Island.
That's
just walking
exactly
around
right.
for attention.
Totally.
The guy with a cat in his head.
Why not?
That man will charge you $5 to take his picture.
Yeah, I know. I got yelled at once.
But the apartment where Dean would do most of his killing would be his very last, 2020 Lamar Street in Pasadena, Texas, in his father's old house. We'll pick back up next time with the last days of Dean Corll and the discovery of the bodies of 29 boys. Mm. 18 of which were killed in 1 year.
God.
What a monster. He's a tyrant and a terrible person.
I got to say, I'm not going to say anything too bad about the victims, but, you know, a lot of those boys were not going to turn out to be anything great.
Well, that was Wayne Henley's exact justification.
Right, isn't
for
that
it.
Fucked up?
Yeah, that's what Wayne Henley said during his confession. He said, oh, you know, all them
we're
boys.
Just killing losers.
He's like, well, they wasn't any good. No one's really going to miss them anyway. So, yeah, we're just Fuck it. Who cares?
Well, that's not right. They had a bright future ahead of them. This is the greatest country on earth, and you can be poor, you can grow up poor, and then you can be president one day.
I'm sorry, your monocle fell off.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's something.
Well, I mean, for the most part, he was right. As far from what I can tell from my research, there were, out of the 29 boys that were missing, 5, maybe 6 families put any effort into looking for them.
No, they just assumed they all ran off. Yeah. Everybody
or
just...
they were, and a lot of them were happy. They're like, well, you know, I don't got to deal with that little piece of shit no more.
It is, it's a rough story.
Yeah, it's a real rough story, and it's only going to get rougher next episode.
All right, so that's part 3 of Dean Corll. How exciting.
I want to give some thank yous real quick.
Yeah.
Thanks, first of all, to research assistant Sammy Coughlin for all of her hard work on this episode. She really bit the bullet on a couple of these... couple of these sexual sadist stuff. She's the one that found that clip of the pedophile at the very beginning.
We had watched a documentary back in the day, and I didn't remember it until I had rewatched it, because you said that clip in the outline, and then I rewatched the whole documentary, and I was on a plane, and that was fun. And I was literally on a plane watching this with it, and they were talking about all the sex. Like, literally, a woman with a baby kept walking past me and, like, looking at me like I was a monster.
Because you are a monster.
I was researching.
She was accurately looking at you.
I would also like to say thank you to Jen Place and Aaron Thomas for the jars of Ted Kaczynski brand Revenge Pickles. Which I already had one jar. They are absolutely delicious.
You ate a whole jar on your own?
In one sitting.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
It was great. It was dinner. Pickle dinner.
You guys never had pickle dinner?
It's not a thing, Marcus.
Pickle dinner is totally a thing.
No. I'm not a bone-laden lizard dude.
Yeah.
Well, you know, things are going a little different in life than they have been, so... Pickle dinner's the way we're living these days.
Man, you're free. That's what you are, man. That means you're free.
We record in a Mexican restaurant.
I love pickles. Also want to thank Tom Bacon for the wall-mounted deer antlers that he sent me, which I will mount above the door to my room to ward off evil spirits.
Hell yeah.
And definitely thank you to Aaron in Georgia, who crocheted us 3 Lil Cthulhus.
They're That's pretty amazing. Cute.
Yeah. And also little Cthulhus.
Holly Carton, we got the print of the H.H. Holmes house diagram that you sent, and it's fucking incredible.
It is amazing.
If you're into it, buy the puzzle. The details on it are insane.
Yeah.
It's really fucking cool.
Yeah, it's a beautiful piece of art. And yeah, anybody out there that's looking, just type in, I think probably H.H. Holmes Murder Castle print, and it'll come up. It'll be the first thing on Google. Fantastic. Definitely go pick one up if you can.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's beautiful.
It is. Now make sure you follow us on Instagram at LP on the left. It's fun.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You can also follow Henry Zebrowski on Twitter at Henry Loves You. Marcus Parks is at Marcus Parks, and I'm at Ben Kissel.
Actually, go ahead and follow me on Instagram. I use Instagram more than anything else.
Now
these
he's
days.
Doing it. Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
This is funny.
I don't know the password. I lost my password and I can't find it.
Huh.
So I that's why I'm stuck to Twitter and Facebook.
I'm at Marcus Parks on Instagram. Huh. Please go follow me. It's fun.
I'm at Ben Kissel 1. It's just bagels and dogs.
You literally have like 7 pictures, and then like one is like of a tombstone, like an empty tombstone that you said insert quote here.
Yeah. So that's kind of exciting.
And go check out my new music show, The Lucky Bone Show.
That's right. And check out all the shows that Marcus and I do. The Roundtable of Gentlemen with Holden and Eddie and Jackie and Kevin Barnett. You'll love that. Abling's Top Pad for politics. It's very fun. Continue on with the sociopathic themes that we touch on here on last podcast.
Check out my character special on Netflix, March 11th.
Yes.
And we'll see everyone in Baltimore. We sold the fuck out.
I can't believe it.
Yeah,
awesome.
We sold out the show. Yeah, man, this is fucking great. We'll see all y'all in Baltimore on March 5th. And it's going to be fucking sweet.
This Saturday, we have our live show right here at the Creek.
Yep.
Yeah. I'll be here for that fucking shit.
Yes.
Fuck yeah, dude. Yeah, go to creeklse.com to get all of the details for the next live show.
Hail Satan.
And the Patreon page, of course.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for all that you have given to us.
Thank you so fucking much. It's amazing. Howdy.
All right. Hail yourselves.
Magustalations.
Yes, please. Magustalations.
All right.
For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to cavecomedyradio.com.